On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. After months of public hearings, private meetings, and political maneuvering, a deal to provide tax increment financing to create the infrastructure for the massive Port Covington development appears to be headed for approval by the Baltimore City Council. A final vote is scheduled for Monday night. This morning, a conversation with Bishop Douglas Miles, a co-chair emeritus of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, one of the groups of community activists who negotiated what many are calling an historic agreement. Then, Joshua Harris is the Green Party candidate for mayor of Baltimore. He'll join me to discuss his vision for the future of Charm City. And A Mother's Lament is a new oratorio composed in response to the Baltimore uprising by James Lee III and librettist Vincent Stringer. They're here with a preview of tomorrow's premiere at Morgan State. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Thanks, Nathan. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to start this morning with a conversation about what's in the agreement surrounding the TIF for Port Covington. After months of public hearings, private meetings, and political maneuvering, a deal to provide tax increment financing to create the infrastructure for the massive Port Covington development appears to be headed for approval by the Baltimore City Council. The Board of Estimates signed off on the package Wednesday, and a final vote in the council is scheduled for Monday night. My guest today is Bishop Douglas Miles, the pastor of Koinonia Baptist Church and a co-chair emeritus of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD, one of the groups of community activists who negotiated what many are calling an historic agreement. Bishop Miles, it is always a pleasure, sir. Thanks so much for your time.
Always a pleasure to join you.
So folks are calling this an historic agreement. You have a perspective of as an activist who's been busy in this town for a long time. What do you think? Is that an accurate characterization?
I think it's extremely accurate. I've been around since the time of the first $2 million that was invested in looking at the Inner Harbor and what could be done to restructure it, and every deal that has been made since then in terms of redevelopment of downtown areas. And this is the first deal that really has in it commitments and promises, not promises, but guarantees and mandates, bringing something uptown for the people of Baltimore.
In July, BILD and you yourself and the leadership team of BILD opposed the deal. You had serious concerns about it. What's in this deal? What strikes you as the most important things that are part of this agreement that you now support wholeheartedly?
The major thing is that we now have some guarantees and mandates in place that were not in place in the original MOU or Community Benefits Agreement. The agreement as proposed originally guaranteed 100 jobs for young people during the summer for 5 years, and about another $7 million in a discretionary kind of funding for the city. Nothing else other than that of any merit other than promises, as most of the other TIFs and pilots that have come down in the city have done. This agreement has in it 30% mandate of local hiring on all infrastructure hiring for the next 10 to 12 years. That's a first in Baltimore, a mandate of local hiring. It has in it $10 million for minority business investment and minority and women business investment, including micro-lending for very small businesses. That was not in the original agreement. And so many other things, 20% affordable housing guaranteed from Sagamore Development, and a $25 million workforce development center, which will be crucial to the life of the city going forward.
Let's talk a little bit about the affordable housing part of this. As you mentioned, they agreed to set aside 20% of housing units for poor and middle-class families. I don't mean this morning to be a debate about Port Covington. I'm going to be moving to midday on Monday here on WIPR, and we're going to be taking up this issue, you know, in much greater detail on that program, probably as early as this coming week. But I want to play for you some comments by a woman named Manisha Chirail. She's an attorney with the Public Justice Center. She was at the negotiating table with you and the leadership team from BUILD. She is working in particular with the community activist Port 3 and BUILD Up Baltimore, that coalition of unions. This is what she had to say about affordable housing.
Under the community benefits agreement, as we've seen it, the developer can opt to make a payment in lieu of about $30,000 to $60,000 for every affordable housing unit it's supposed to develop but fails to develop. However, it can offset this payment in lieu by the entire cost of any units it develops, which is about $172,000 a piece. Even though the developer has agreed to a requirement of 20% affordable housing, it can actually make less than 5% of its proposed 5,300 or so units affordable and technically be in compliance with the agreement. Second, the developer could choose to make all of its housing affordable to those at 80% of area median income, which is around $69,000 for a family of four. Only if the developer gets additional public subsidies in the form of low-income housing tax credits, does it have to go beyond that and make housing affordable for households at 60% of AMI or around $52,000 for a family of four. But Baltimore's median household income is $41,000, and about 24% of our city lives in poverty. The deal offers virtually nothing to families at those income levels.
So again, I don't want this to be a debate. We're going to have debates about Port Covington and about the validity or lack thereof of this deal in the future. But in general, what is your reaction to that? There's a lot of facts and figures there. And for folks who haven't been covering this, you know, haven't been paying that close attention to it, it's kind of deep in the weeds. But if, in fact, the median household income in the city of Baltimore is around $41,000 and this affordable housing appears to be directed towards people who are making considerably more, where do you think that stands, and how's that going to move forward?
Well, is the deal perfect? No. Any deal you make, there's also the need to hold people accountable for what they agree to do. The deal has in it a significant commitment toward what's called 30% AMI, or average median income, which would include persons who are on Section A vouchers and so forth. And it's dependent upon the contractor's ability to get certain tax credits and so forth. So that's where the community pressure has to stay on Sagamore to make sure that that happens. Is it a perfect deal? No. But anytime you have the potential of 1,000 affordable homes in Baltimore, you've got to take the opportunity to press for that.
So much of these negotiations really come down to, at some level, a basic human trust between your team, your leadership team at BUILD, and the other activists who are at the table, and the folks representing Sagamore. You sat with them day after day for, 10, 11 days straight of negotiations, and this was a long process that happened late last month. Does this come down to a matter of you are... You and the BUILD leadership team feel comfortable with the assurances that you've received from Sagamore?
Well, part of it's based on assurances and relationship, and that's I think that that's key in any type of political arena. It's all about relationship and public relationship, not friendship, but public relationship. But in the agreement, there are certain things that are mandated that have to be kept, that have to be met, and there are oversight boards to assure that they are. Sagamore will give money to the city to hire an additional auditor to audit the project. Again, you make the deal, but after that, you have to make sure the deal is kept. Going back to Reagan, trust but verify.
Bishop Douglas Miles from Koinonia Baptist Church. He's a co-chair emeritus of Baltimore's United in Leadership Development. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Talk to me a little bit about your take on the relationship of the unions and your fellow pastors in the community of Black clergy here in Baltimore. I'm hearing on the street that there's perhaps a little friction between Black churches and unions, which tend to be sort of majority white run. You were at the table together. You were on the same side of this negotiation. But where do things stand in terms of trust in that dynamic?
Right. I don't think it was so much a matter of trust as it was what the union saw in its self-interest. That at one point, at some point, diverged from what we felt was in the best self-interest of Baltimore overall and the black church and the faith community overall. So it's not a matter of trust. We've worked together on other issues. We operate on the system, no permanent enemies, no permanent allies, just permanent self-interest. And on this issue, we disagreed with the unions. It's our hope that we will be able to work with them as they move through the project to strengthen their relationship with the project.
And you mentioned that you're going to keep the pressure on Sagamore to make sure that not only are they monitored, and as you mentioned, there's money in the city, there's a person or an office that's going to be in charge of keeping track of this. But what sort of leverage do you have continuing moving forward? How will you be able to keep the pressure on Sagamore?
Well, again, the basic thing is just public pressure and the fact that there are certain mandates in the agreement that have penalties with it that if those mandates are not met. I think what many Baltimoreans or some Baltimoreans may be missing is that Sagamore is giving $100 million literally upfront money. The Workforce Development Center, the commitment around minimum wage for construction workers on the infrastructure of $17 an hour plus benefits. So there's certain things that are mandated, and pressure can be brought to bear even legally in some instances.
As we finish up here, sir, one of the things that is of great concern to a lot of folks is the impact on school funding that the Port Covington development will have. Are you satisfied that moving forward, the Baltimore City Public Schools are not going to suffer financially because of this project?
Well, that's up in the air, and that's something that has to be really resolved on the state level. It has to do with a lot of formula that's related to development, not just at Port Covington, but other development that has taken place in the city. Our effort will be to change state law and state formula over the next 2 years so that education in Baltimore is held
harmless. So this got to go back to the legislature.
Has to go back to the legislature.
All right. Well, Bishop Miles, it is always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much, and we look forward to continuing conversations about this.
Thank you.
Bishop Douglas Miles is the pastor of Koinonia Baptist Church and the co-chair emeritus of Baltimore's United in Leadership Development. We'll have more on Port Covington in the coming weeks as the Maryland Morning Team migrates to midday at noon. I'll start hosting midday on Monday, and we will be covering the Port Covington story as it evolves, perhaps, as I said, as early as this coming week, so stay tuned. Coming up, Joshua Harris joins me here in Studio A. He's the Green Party candidate for mayor of Baltimore. We'll find out about his vision for Charm City after a break for the news. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Next, another installment in our Talking with the Candidates series. Joshua Harris is the Green Party's nominee for mayor of Baltimore. He will face Democratic Senator Catherine Pugh and Republican candidate Alan Walden in the November 8th election. Mr. Harris is 30 years old. He lives in the Hollins Market area of southwest Baltimore. He's a community activist and the co-founder of Hollins Creative Placemaking. In addition, he's the managing editor of The Sphinx, the magazine of Alpha Phi Alpha, the African-American national fraternity that's based here in Baltimore. He's also a former legislative aide for Delegate Charles Sidner, who represents parts of Baltimore County. A Chicago native and a graduate of Augsburg College in Minneapolis, Mr. Harris moved to Baltimore in 2012. This week, he was named Best Politician in the City Paper's annual Best of Baltimore issue, and he joins me in the studio. It's good to see you, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So as the best politician, according to the to the City Paper, is that an encomium? Is that a slander? I mean, this is the year of the outsider. Is that a good thing?
I guess so. It was actually determined by readers. So readers, they took a poll for readers, and they voted. I didn't quite think I was there yet, but I guess I'm officially a politician.
There you go. Congratulations or condolences, whatever. You began in this race many months ago as a Democrat. You decided to switch to the Green Party. Explain how that happened.
Well, I was always considering running as an independent, and I knew of the Green Party. A friend and mentor of mine, Rosa Clemente, who's an activist, ran on the vice presidential ticket for the Green Party in 2008. I just wasn't familiar with the Green Party locally, and I found out that I actually was. And I found out that many of the people involved in the Green Party locally have been very active on the ground in social justice movement. And so for me, the Green Party is a party that has been very outspoken and vocal about issues of social justice, racial justice, economic justice, and environmental justice, all values that are near and dear to my heart. And I've also understand I'm a student of history. And so understanding the history of Baltimore City, while we're a Democratic title in town, in nature, the policies that have been implemented have really been Republican. Understanding our propensity to favor major corporations at the expense of schools, neighborhood, and people, that's what we traditionally see under Republican administrations. And so I think that Baltimore needs a change and needs leadership that's unafraid to go against the grain and do what may not be the popular thing to do, but stand for what's right and stand for people over corporate interests.
You stood for people. As a matter of fact, you lied down for people on Tuesday night, just this week. You and, as a matter of fact, Jill Stein, the president, presidential candidate for the Green Party, and her vice presidential candidate have supported you as well. Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's going to be on Midday with me in a few weeks, who's the senatorial candidate for the Green Party. You slept on the streets of Baltimore on Tuesday night. Tell us how that went.
Well, yes, it was. We really wanted to bring awareness to the issue of homelessness and poverty in Baltimore City. We hear about it and we know that it exists. But all too often, as we drive past so many homeless people on the streets of Baltimore every day, we become disconnected and we sometimes fail to realize that these are human beings. They're people who have stories, who have lives, and they've ended up in this situation due to failed circumstances. And you never know, there's no cookie-cutter approach as to why an individual becomes homeless. And so we wanted to really bring awareness to the issue and some faces to humanize the issue of homelessness in Baltimore City.
What did you learn personally about it that you think you didn't know on Monday night?
I think one of the biggest things that I learned and one of the things that we saw there is that we had a bail enforcement agent who came down and just started snatching people's tents open in the middle of the night, and they were looking for someone. And they knew they were in the wrong because as soon as we came over, they left. And that just because someone's homeless doesn't mean that they don't have rights, doesn't mean that they should be dehumanized or disrespected. And so I also spent a lot of time talking to individuals and finding out their stories as to how they ended up. There's even one young man who came back who was homeless in 2012 with his daughter down there, and he comes back now to talk to his friends and to bring whatever resources he can now that he's employed and off the street. And so just listening to people was an eye-opening experience, and I really reiterated the need for more advocacy on the issue of homelessness in Baltimore City.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Joshua Harris. He is the Green Party candidate for mayor in the city of Baltimore. Can you describe your personal philosophy of governing? I mean, is it completely in sync with the philosophy as people understand it of the Green Party? Do you find any places in which you diverge from the national ticket, for example, or the Green Party philosophy in general?
I think that my focus in looking at on the local level specifically, it's about uniting a divided city, making sure that Baltimore works for all of us. All of our children deserve equal access and opportunity to be successful. And that's something that we haven't seen. Whether you're talking about right now, we're giving Port Covington $660 million while we have schools where our kids can't drink water and they don't have heat. But really making sure that the way that we govern is effective in the business of policy and how it impacts our constituents. Rather than just being so quick to favor those corporate entities over the citizens of Baltimore. And that's something that I don't think that we've seen in quite some time in Baltimore City, someone who's willing to put people first. So that's really what my philosophy is, putting people, because it's the people that make Baltimore City great. It's the people who have been working to sustain and build Baltimore for years, and they deserve to be invested in.
Bishop Miles and I were just talking about the Port Covington Agreement. He's been an activist in this town for a long, long time. He's very much in favor of this agreement because, in this case, floating these bonds for this major corporation, Under Armour, is going to create a lot of jobs. It's going to make housing available to people who might not otherwise have it available. So they would argue that there is a direct impact on people's lives by working with and partnering with corporations like Under Armour. How do you see the Port Covington deal in particular? What would be different about it if you were the mayor right now?
Absolutely. I think that it's commendable the work that Bill did to really push to try to get something for the city out of this deal. And we can get into the weeds and the details of the community benefits agreement, but really what we've seen in Baltimore City, we've seen what they call public-private partnership, where we publicize the debt and we privatize the profit. And I don't think that that's a true sustainable model for development of a city. We have to look at this deal much larger than just a microcosm of right now in Port Covington, understanding that we're going to lose at least $50 million a year in school funding. We can't afford that. That's something that they decided to make this decision before the legislature had the ability to reformat this school funding formula.
But they have confidence that the legislature will revise the formula and that that problem can be fixed. That's a problem that a lot of people have identified, certainly.
And then why sign the contract before that's done? You can have confidence that you want, but there's no guarantees there. There's also understanding a regional sustainability model, understanding the Opportunity Collaborative and the work that's been done there. Where does Port Covington fit in with that plan and that vision for how we build the city regionally? Making sure or understanding that if we're going to give a TIF this large, why not just expand the TIF to include Westport and Cherry Hill rather than giving the money to the developer and then letting the developer decide what they're willing to give the community? That's what true community partnerships look like. But instead, what we've seen is that we have more faith in businesses because they have all the right answers, and we trust them more than anything, more than we do the community in particular. So we're just going to let them give the community whatever they decide, rather than truly partnering with the community to make this a comprehensive community development vision for the city as a whole. And that's not what we've seen with Port Covington. And I can go into the details and the weeds, but that would take quite some time.
Sure.
As someone who's read 367 pages of the application, there's many things that could be done differently.
And you're no stranger to TIFs. You actually worked on one. You were part of a community group involved in a TIF involving the University of Maryland Biopark on the west side. What about the characterization of this deal? It says this really is precedent setting. This is a very different kind of TIF than happened with the Biopark or that happened with the Hilton Hotel that happened with Harbor East. This is a very different universe, given that the developer is, you know, in it for about $139 million right up front.
Yeah, but we're talking about a billionaire developer who's in it. So when you compare that in the greater scheme, yes, it's precedented because it's one of the largest in the country. So, of course, anything that's done, even a community benefits agreement. And so knowing that this has been done before and we've seen this, whether you talk about the University of Maryland Biopark 14 years ago when they first were given a sunny day loan from the state under the auspices that they would create thousands of jobs to impact the Pohomes community and give jobs and employment for those areas in poverty over there, which we have not seen 14 years later. And now they're being given $17.5 million. So people had faith then, and there were people who came to the table and said, we believe that they're gonna do this and make this right, and we haven't seen it yet. And so we really need to make sure that we're putting accountability metrics into these deals and more of an inclusive approach to how we develop. There are cities that have done this, whether you talk about Charlotte, who's really not only improved in increasing business development, but also community relations and minimizing poverty in the city. You have Grand Rapids, Michigan that has done this. And so they're more on the lines with true community-based development models that we can look to for how we not only improve the city and develop our downtown, but develop uptown and really raise the median family household income. Because until we begin to do that, we're only displacing problems rather than creating solutions to the problem.
Joshua Harris is the Green Party candidate for mayor of the city of Baltimore. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WYPR. Mr. Harris, the Department of Justice issued a few weeks ago a scathing report about the Baltimore City Police Department. A consent decree is going to be developed in the coming weeks between the DOJ and the city of Baltimore. What are the parameters or the dimensions of a consent decree you think should be part of that agreement?
Well, we actually have a press conference later on this afternoon about that, a community coalition called Stand Up Baltimore, the Coalition for the Transformation and Betterment of Baltimore. And there's many things that we'd like to see in that, probably the largest being really accountability for individual officers that are found to be in violation or violating individuals' rights or found in the wrong. They have to be held accountable and understand that it's no longer the citizens that will foot the bill for their wrongdoings. Let me backpedal a little bit. For this report, it's even more disheartening and discouraging that people are acting shocked. as a young black man in Baltimore, understanding what I've had to deal with dealing with police in my own community, understanding this is a city that shells out millions of dollars a year in police brutality lawsuits for the elected leadership who was signing those checks to act as if they did not know this was going on or that this is a surprise and now they want to do something about it. That's even more problematic. You have people who fund, who sit on public safety committees and fund the police department knowing what has happened, and that's problematic. And that's what we need to change, because that leadership has allowed this to happen and has not said anything prior to this moment in this report coming out, despite reports and complaints from citizens of Baltimore. And that's really what we need to change, and why I believe Baltimore needs a fresh start and leadership that is truly committed to investing and working for the people of Baltimore.
But then would you not agree to compensate families who've been victims of police misconduct and brutality? I mean, if the citizens of Baltimore aren't going to pick up the tab for police misconduct, how do these families get justice and get compensated?
Oh, absolutely no. The agency has to be held accountable for those. However, I'm saying that the officers should also be held accountable and have their insurance benefits or their benefits lost or their pension lost to finance something to really hold them accountable and say that I have to think twice before I make this decision. That's what we have to really put in place. I'm not saying not pay out those who have been victims, but really making sure that officers understand that they will have to pay as well.
Mm-hmm. What can you do as the mayor that you think can really place your imprint and move the city forward? I mean, the particular office of mayor of the city of Baltimore, the particular authority that office has, what do you think as the mayor you'll be able to do to change the climate, as you say, to disrupt what's been going on previously and to change the direction and move the needle?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And so my platform is called Banking for Baltimore Undivided, and the staple of it is something that's called public banking. And so public banking is under the concept of understanding that right now our city's $2.7 billion operating budget is sitting in a bank on Wall Street. And then that bank on Wall Street leverages it to make investments and make its CEOs and its investors wealthy while the city sees no return on that. Then, in fact, like we're about to do for Port Covington, we go up to Wall Street and we take out a municipal bond. In this case, Port Covington, $660 million. In some cases in Baltimore, we're paying upwards of 15% interest on those bonds. The citizens end up footing that bill. If we were to simply remove our money from that Wall Street bank and open up our own Baltimore City Public Bank, we can leverage it and make the exact same investments that they do on Wall Street. But now every penny of interest earned comes back into the city, and we need to finance the changes to move forward our city. So this is how we're going to finance what needs to be done. And we can say that immediately we want 40% of all interest earned to go directly towards to start making sure that our children can drink the water in schools, that they have heat in the wintertime and air conditioning in the summertime. We can say we want another 20% to go directly towards infrastructure repairs and making sure that when you and I drive up and down the roads, we aren't having to replace tires and axles so frequently. We can say that we want another 20% to go towards workforce development, because what happens in Baltimore...
Are there precedents for this? Are there other cities doing this, or public banks? So you're saying that right now, that rather than have investors, fund things, like, because these bonds are going to be purchased by investors. Mm-hmm. What makes you think that they would purchase bonds from a public bank any more easily than they'd purchase it from Wall Street?
Well, in Baltimore's case, with our budget, that's money that's guaranteed from income tax revenue and other revenue throughout the year, we could float our own bonds in many cases. Even if we just started with our $98 million rainy day fund, what we can do with leveraging that to make investments. And there's a precedent that's already been set at North Dakota, has a North Dakota public bank where they've avoided every stock market crash for the last 100 years because the bank isn't driven by profit. So they aren't so aggressive with their investments. Any interest earned is a benefit to the city, or to the state in that case. They most recently were able to cut student loan interest rates in half for all students that had loans through the North Dakota Public Bank, because again, the bank isn't driven by profit. So all interest is a benefit to the citizens. And so there's also models overseas that we can look to as an example. And it's really about understanding what Senator Sanders talked about on the national level and how Wall Street impacts our lives directly, whether we realize it or not.
Well, very quickly, just have about 30 seconds. I assume you support Ms. Stein, Dr. Stein, for president of the Green Party. Ralph Nader drew about 2.7% of the vote when he ran against Al Gore and George Bush, and that election went to George Bush. What do you think about the folks who say that the Green Party could siphon off votes from Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump president?
I think that if that's their fear, they should get out and begin to register voters to make sure that that doesn't happen, because we have, I believe it's about, about 500 million people that don't vote consistently. So that's one of your friends, one of your family members that isn't voting. So make sure that they get out to the polls this November.
Not 500 million, but
there's a lot don't vote. And vote for your conscience and vote for what you believe is right rather than what you're afraid of.
All right. Well, Joshua Harris, it's terrific to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time, and we will see you soon.
Thank you.
Joshua Harris is the Green Party nominee for mayor of Baltimore. He'll join Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka at a fundraiser and Get Out the Vote rally tonight at 7 o'clock at the Downtown Cultural Arts Center in Baltimore. As I mentioned earlier in the show, beginning Monday, I'll be hosting Midday. We will, of course, cover the November 8th election up and down the ballot. Next month, we'll have a conversation on Midday with all three candidates for mayor of Baltimore, Senator Pugh, Alan Walden, and Mr. Harris. We look forward to that discussion. Also beginning Monday, Sheila Cast will begin her new show, On the Record, which you'll hear weekday mornings at 9:30 here on WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up later in this program, Mother's Lament, a new oratorio that addresses the epidemic of violence in the African-American community. We'll talk to the creative team behind the world premiere at Morgan State tomorrow night. That's coming up after a break for the news. First, it's time for a Baltimore story with Gil Sandman.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Tomorrow night at Morgan State University, a new oratorio by the internationally acclaimed African-American composer James Lee III will receive its world premiere. Dr. Lee is on the faculty at Morgan State, as is collaborator on this project, Vincent Dion Stringer, who heads the Morgan State Opera Department. He wrote the libretto for the new piece. It's called Mother's Lament, So Many Names Unknown, So Many Sons Lost. James Lee III and Vincent Dion Stringer join me in the studio. Guys, it's great to see you.
It's great to see you.
It's great to be
here. Thanks
for having
us. So, Vincent, the idea for this project with you and James came out of the uprising in April of 2015.
Actually, it came from the uprising in Ferguson. And James Lee contacted me from Brazil while he was on Fulbright. And he was watching this unfold on CNN. And he reached out to me via Facebook and asked me to write a text for it. He wanted to express something musically. So he encouraged me to read the Lamentations of Jeremiah, and that inspired the Lamentations of a Prisoner of Hope, which Mother's Lament is chapter 2 of that.
Yeah,
work in progress.
And James, what a difficult challenge it is to capture in sound, to capture in harmony and melody and rhythm, the intense and nuanced and complex emotions surrounding events like Ferguson or Cleveland or Baltimore or this, you know, Baton Rouge, this long list of places that have become iconic now.
Oh, yes. I remember when I asked Vincent to set this particular Lamentations, which is now Mother's Lament, it was very helpful for me to hear him read the poem and recite it. And I meditated on it, and I thought about I reflected on that, and I thought about the actual cadences throughout the text and how I would actually provide a musical commentary to these events.
This is part of a series of things that you're doing at Morgan, Vincent, the Freedom, Love, and Light Project. What's that?
Well, the Freedom, Love, and Light Project is our way as artists of remembering the loved ones lost in the city of Baltimore to violence, honoring their families. Tomorrow night, this is a multimedia tribute to families who've lost loved ones to violence. So there will be mothers and fathers, family members, brothers and sisters and cousins sitting in the audience whose names, the names of their loved ones will appear on the screen during a second movement, Mother's Fear. But also in the program, there'll be a list of the names, the Many Names Unknown Project, which is right now about 1,000 names from January of 2013 to the present day. And we're going to, over time, go through and really develop profiles on each of these individuals, moving them from a statistical number to a real person, a loved one that is remembered by photographs and stories.
So, James, give us the lay of the land here in terms of the forces you have. Vincent mentioned it's a multimedia presentation. Who's all involved in this?
Well, in the musical aspect, it's Marquita Lister singing the soprano part. It's for soprano and treble voices, which will include the women from the Morgan State University Choir. And then there are men's chorus, orchestra. And then there's also an aspect where Eric Briscoe has painted this wonderful, done this wonderful painting of a mother and her three sons looking up in terms of a mother's prayer that reflects the last movement. And then we also have videos of video recordings of women and mothers who have expressed their grief at the loss of their son.
So this is violence and loss of life, not just police misconduct, but just, you know, throughout the community.
Throughout the community. There's a question in the poem. The threat, and it's a statement, the threat is very real out there, but who's the bigger threat? My son, our community, the police? Where exactly does the danger lay? That's a poignant question. And on Sunday afternoon, we will have a dialogue at the University Chapel from 4 to 6 with some of those mothers and clergy and community leaders participating in a discussion about that question. So there is in addition, there is an art exhibition, a civil arts movement by some of the young people that have participated in the Youth Arts Institute at Morgan this summer. They've created works of art in expression that opens today and will remain open until the end of October in the atrium at the James E. Lewis Museum.
Yeah, so you're touching all the bases artistically here. I mean, visual art, music, performance, you know, videos, that kind of thing. I mean, James, what's the obligation of artists to address issues like this, issues of our time?
I think one obligation is art, especially in my field in music and composition, has a way of reaching to the inner soul of a person more than perhaps a visual representation, because music somehow passes the various nerves in our brain that moves us and moves our emotions to want to make positive change, effect positive change. And I think this particular work and what has become of my musical commentary along with the text will hopefully really bring about that emotion in one so that they will want to help to bring about a positive change, more peace and less violence.
Yeah, so this is about moving people to make a difference.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, break a leg, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, the three of us have worked together on many projects.
Absolutely.
And I have just the highest respect for you. And I'm just sick that I can't make the premiere, but I look forward to hearing a recording and talking to you more about it. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Vincent Dion Stringer and James Lee III are the creative team behind Mother's Lament, So Many Names Unknown, So Many Sons Lost. You can catch the world premiere of this new oratorio tomorrow night at the Gilliam Concert Hall in the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University. Julian Benishew conducts the Mid-Atlantic Orchestra with soprano Marquita Lister, bass baritone Robert Cantrell, and the renowned Morgan State University Choir, the Singing Sensations Youth Choir, and singers from several HBCU choruses. The concert begins at 8. We've got a link to the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today, and after 10 and a half years, this is the final edition of Maryland Morning. As I've mentioned earlier, beginning Monday, we're happy to introduce On the Record, a new interview program that my friend and colleague Sheila Cast will host weekday mornings from 9:30 to 10. I'll be moving to midday, Monday through Friday at noon. Our guest on Monday will be Dr. Sonia Santelices, the president and CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We'll check in with her about how this new school year is going and what her plans are as she settles into her new job. I'm looking forward to my new job here at WIPR, and on behalf of all of us who have been part of bringing you Maryland Morning over the years, thank you for tuning in and being part of this program. Back in 2006, Sheila, Nathan, and I were honored to be given the opportunity to be with you most mornings, and I hope you'll continue to tune in as Sheila returns to the mornings with On the Record and as I migrate to the noon hour with Midday. All of us on the teams of both shows pledge to you our commitment to bringing you stories that matter and voices who reflect the full spectrum of what's going on in our communities and beyond. The director, engineer, and co-host of Maryland Morning is Nathan Sterner. Nathan, it has been a great pleasure working with you on this gig. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much yourself, Tom.
The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded our theme music, Coffee for Our Guests, provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor is up next with the Writer's Almanac. I'll see you on midday on Monday. Have a great weekend.